And we welcome you back. Tim McGinnis on tap here on Teacher Tuesday. We hope you've learned a lot already. If you haven't, you're about to. My next guest is one of the great ladies who ever played this game and has been an ambassador for it for longer than most of us have been able to hit a golf ball. I'm talking about the one and only Carol Mann joining us now. Carol, welcome to the show. Thank you for being a part of it.
Well, thank you, John. It's so good to hear from you again. Well, and I've followed all your work over there at XM and Sirius, and I'm real proud of you and what you've done in your afterlife.
That is quite a nice way to put it, the afterlife, because there's your life as a player, and then there is the life after the life of a player, isn't there?
Yes.
It's very well put. So many reasons to have you on the show this week, not the least of which is the PGA Tour is in your backyard. The LPGA Tour is playing its first major. So many exciting things to talk about. Let's start with the LPGA Tour, and specifically with what Yanni Tseng has been able to do at a very young age. And the reason that I want to start with her is because you were very young and started winning majors at a very young age. Talk about what that mentality is like of going out there and mixing it up with the best players in the world when you're really right out of college or just shortly thereafter, and all of a sudden you're in contention in major championships.
I can tell you it's scary. At least it was for me. Because I didn't have quite the amateur background that Yanni did as a junior and then as a competing amateur player, and then having turned pro at such a young age. I turned pro at 19, but I didn't have a lot of experience like she did. So the point is that it is scary to, because John, here's the thing. You work and work and work and never, you can dream about competing with, you know, your idols and your heroes, but then to actually be doing it, it's like you have to keep pinching yourself, you know, and it's like, is this really, am I doing this or is this still a dream?
Carol, you weren't just competing. You were beating the heck out of them there for a nice stretch of years. But we'll get to all that in just a few minutes. 1964, the Women's Western Open. 1965, the Women's U.S. Open. That's two of your first three wins of 38, ladies and gentlemen, of 38 wins on the LPGA Tour. That's pretty heady stuff right out of the gate.
Well, I believe me, I wasn't prepared for winning the Women's Western Open. And as a matter of fact, when I finished that round, it was a double round that day because we'd had a rain out in the previous, the third round. So we played this double round. And so the scoreboards were, you know, kind of behind and we didn't have that many. So as I finished at number 18, I knew I was doing well, but I didn't know I was winning. And so I said to someone at the end, just going to the scores 10, well, who won? And they turned to me and they said, you did. I'm not kidding. I was amazed that I won that tournament, although I knew I was doing well and I chunked it up the last hole like a hack, frankly. And I bogeyed. I was so nervous. Holy cow. You know, nobody prepares you for what changes occur in your body when you get under that kind of pressure and that opportunity to win.
That is so true. Even it doesn't necessarily even mean the first time you're out of your comfort zone, your body most definitely changes. I don't think there's any question about that. Did they even have a women's golf team at UNC Greensboro when you were there?
I don't know. They didn't, but I got a scholarship for $100. But you know what? I had to work it off as a lifeguard. I made 50 cents an hour to work off my $100 scholarship.
They had you. You were, that's indentured servitude.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Imagine what these young women get today when they go to college and Title IX. It's the 40th anniversary of Title IX, by the way, this year.
Right.
And I've worked, I can't even tell you. We'll join with others, Billie Jean King, Chris Everett, Martina, lots of, you know, individual athletes and Olympians as well in Washington, D.C. to to advocate for Title IX. We couldn't lobby. You can't lobby if you're part of a nonprofit group. So as part of the Women's Sports Foundation, we advocated. So we chased congressmen and senators all over the halls of Congress, and chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Dan Rostenkowski, from Chicago politics, to get a support for Title IX when it was endangered.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I've done that a lot and been among several presidents and so on to advocate for it. I handed Jimmy Carter a stack of 13 million constituents during 79 when the John Tower Amendment, which had Father Hesburgh of Notre Dame and Walter Byers of the NC2A, the football coalition, basically, against Title IX because they all believed that it was going to ruin college football.
Right.
And of course,
they
it
did.
Hasn't.
No. Yeah. I think college football is doing just fine.
I think it has. And so are women athletes. I mean, we have Olympic records being downed all the time by the collegiate women and having more experience and more opportunity to compete and learn and grow and be coached and access the bigger and better competition. So that's what Title IX was really all about. They said women wouldn't come, and of course they have. They're in the tens of thousands playing sports all over America.
I agree. My daughter would rather play sports than do anything else at this point. I don't know that I'll be able to keep her with that mindset when she's a teenager, but I'm going to try. Any advice you can give me there, Carol, I would greatly appreciate.
Well, it's really good if teenagers can participate in team sports because then they can be in relationships. It's really important for young females to feel like they're in relationship with some bodies or something, okay? For me, I gave up all other sports, including teams. I mean, I played a little high school field hockey and basketball, but we were half court then. Holy cow, what a waste. But I went to individual sports because I preferred them. I wanted to be in control, you know, and I didn't want to have to count on others. So, but it's really documentable that team sports do really.
Oh, it's the dumbest dog in the world, Carol.
What?
I said, I apologize for the dog in the background. It's my dog and it's the dumbest one in the world.
Oh, well, I have a cat and she's allowed to show up to fight me. So don't worry about that.
Anyway, I apologize for the interruption was the point.
Okay. It's all right. The main thing is, I think I was just trying to point out that all our research shows that a young female, teenage age females, prefer team sports. And because of the ability to be in relationship with their friends.
I never really considered the social aspect of it, but I think you're absolutely right now that I think about it. Our guest is Carol Mann. She is among the fabulous members of the World Golf Hall of Fame, which I'm sure was a terrific honor. And I will get to some of that in a minute. I want to talk about the fact that there was a woman playing on the LPGA Tour who may have been as good as anyone who had ever played. And you kind of stuck your toe right in the middle in 1969 and made sure that she didn't win 9 money titles in a row. You won one right in the middle over Kathy Whitworth. Talk about about playing with her and what that relationship, we talk about relationships, what that relationship was like.
Well, Kathy and I were buddies from having done clinic and exhibition work for Wilson back in the mid-60s. And I'll tell you, you got to get buddies with people when you travel from San Francisco to Valdosta, Georgia, 62 days and give 46 clinics along the way. All right. So we had a big celebration in Valdosta, Georgia. We both got drunk as skunks, okay, because it was over, okay? So anybody that you get that drunk with, you know, you're buddies with. So as my game developed, and Kathy's game, of course, went in to the moon in the mid-60s and the late 60s. But I think while we might have been considered rivals, I think I just had such respect for her and her game, and she had a growing respect for mine because I was getting better all the time, you know. And matter of fact, one time she said, well, it's about time. We've been waiting for her to play this good, you know, thinking that I could have played that good, but I was just messing around otherwise. And she was a wonderful competitor to help drive me to be better. And that's what you want in a competitor. And that's why players have such regard for Yanni, the women players. It makes them better. And why the men players have such regard for Tiger, you know, and they did for Jack when he was, you know, being such a prolific winner. Anyhow, so Kathy Whitworth and I won two out of every three golf tournaments we played in 1969.
And 1968 wasn't too bad for you guys either.
No, I agree. But in 69, we won two out of three. So I mean, it was the Kathy and Carol show, and it was fun. I'm telling you, it was fun.
I could imagine it was fun. Were there some major championships in there that got away that still haunt you? We're all haunted as golfers. I don't care how successful you were. There's the one that got away. Is there one of those stories in there?
Well, in 65, I won the U.S. Women's Open. 66, we played at Hazeltine, the very first time a national tournament had been played at Hazeltine. And this is before any of the renovations, so it's pre-Dave Hill. This is the cow pasture. Statement that he made during the men's 70 U.S. Open up there, and which Tony Jacklin won. And so we're at Hazeltine, and Sandra Spook in the tournament, but she double bogeyed the 71st hole. And I made a par, and I was coming on. I had to birdie the 18th hole to tie her. She was already in the clubhouse. So I hit my ball up there really close, about 15 feet away, and I hit the best putt you could ever imagine, and the ball, it's like it went in the hole, and the fickle finger of somebody, you know, kicked it back out. And so I missed, and I lost that tournament, or getting into a tie by one. That's probably the most vivid loss I can recall in a major. I came in second one other time to Sandra Haney at LaGrange in 1974. And she holed an 80-footer on the 71st hole, that little devil. And so I missed out on that. Missed out getting a playoff that day. So anyhow, but they all were learning experiences, and they all help you be better. And they find out, you know, you got to suffer. If you want to be a winner, you also have to be able to suffer. And I know Tom Watson talked a lot about pain and how painful golf can be. And I'm here to tell you, I couldn't agree more. But that suffering and the pain that you experience when you lose, or when you fail, is a driver. It can be a real driver to create energy to go and find out, okay, what do I need to do now? How do I need to get better?
Right. Talk about the end of your career. I mean, it was so prolific there for a dozen years. Did you think about playing longer, or what was there a point in time where you'd said, you know what, it's time to step away. It's time to make room for somebody else.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I had, and this will talk to you about a little bit about the pain. I won my eighth tournament of the year in 1969 in Toronto. And I ended up that afternoon in my hotel room after I'd just been, you know, applauded by 10,000 people at the close of the tournament. I ended up in my hotel room in the dark, shades drawn, lights off, sitting in a corner, crying my eyes out for about 3 hours. Now you're going, well, wait a minute, I mean, you should have been celebrating. Well, that's what happened. I don't know how else to tell you. That's what happened. And so from that experience, I changed some things in my life to get some help, because I was out of balance, John. Right. It was just that simple. I was great at doing golf, but I was terrible at everything else. And I didn't know how to do anything else. And I didn't want to know, frankly, how to do anything else. And, I didn't want to be in relationships. I didn't want to, everything I wanted was casual and shallow and just, love them and leave them and then move on to the next place, And so I really had to get some help to, with a doctor and get tested. And I was tested as kind of having the emotional development of a 12-year-old. Uh-oh, you're going, holy cow, she's really telling me something here. Well, because some things had happened personally when I was about 12 that I swore I would never be like to my mother, okay? And so basically what I did is I shut myself down. Right. A part of me shut down. And I didn't know that that would happen. I just knew that I was driven not to be like my mother, okay? In a lot of ways, and so I not have a life like she had. So she was a tortured alcoholic, okay? Right. And so I didn't want that in my life. So I had to do a lot of work on me. And as a result of that, my doctors often warned me, that could change your golf career, because some of the reasons why you may have done this is because of those issues, and why I've done so well and why I've, excelled, basically. But that's out of balance, okay? So I kept going to try to get my life more in balance. And in 1976, I met Jim Hardy at a golf training school that I signed up to be with Golf Digest. I met him in 76 and we dated 76, 77, 78, and we got married in 79. And we set up housekeeping over in Palm Springs because that's where he was going to teach. And I moved from Baltimore to Palm Springs, and I basically became, Mrs. Hardy. But not to the world. I didn't use his name in public. I just used it in private. And but I was more balanced, and I actually could have a married relationship, even though we each had still issues. You know what I mean?
Sure. I've been married. I understand.
Yeah. Okay. So anyhow, the marriage didn't last but 7.5 years. But we're friends now. A lot of forgiveness has to happen, and not just of the other person, but also yourself for the things that you create to cause failure and loss of, love and affection and all that stuff. So, but we're great friends and colleagues, and I'm a certified plain truth instructor, having gone to many of his workshops and seminars, and I'm still a great admirer of him and the work he's done. I'm real proud of him. And so I think we'll always be friends.
It's a terrific story. And during that, you still not only played competitively, but were winning golf tournaments as well. I mean, it wasn't, yeah. I think a lot of people, when faced with the decision of, do I want a whole life or do I want to be the best golfer on the planet, may have gone the other way, Carol.
Well, I know, but there was something inside of me that said, look, my life is more important than this.
Wow.
And so that's how it was easy for me to keep going. And, I still work on myself. Once you're into recognizing that I'm not saying it's about me. I don't mean narcissism. I mean that if I want something in the world, or I need something in the world, relationships or, whatever, I'm responsible to go do that. I can't sit and wait for somebody to bring it to me. So, I was basically being a victim when I allowed myself not to want to be like my mother. I was letting myself be victimized by what I believed to be true about her. It wasn't always all true, by the way. It was just what I saw.
For sure.
So, it's like in golf taught me this more than anything else. I mean, the therapy helped, but I was ready for it because golf taught me You have to be willing to uncover any rock about your game, about your skills, if you really want to be better. You know, I mean, Nicholas has always said that. Watson says it. You know, every great champion has always told that to us. You know, just keep looking for the answers. Keep searching. So that's what I do.
It's terrific. It really is. And I think that the fact that you took a lot of that energy, particularly after your golf career, and you made other people's lives better, whether it was their golf games or the advocacy for women. I mean, you've been involved. I met you at charity outings during my career, and you seemed to be at anything that needed your help. You were there.
Well, I did corporate hospitality for 22 years on the men's tour.
Right.
For the same client. So I had an opportunity to watch, you know, men's golf change dramatically from the late 70s to the early 2000s, which included, you know, the emergence of Greg Norman, the proliferation of Watson, the excellence of Nicholas still in there, Sam Snead, you know, I mean, such a mixture of generations, and then culminating in Tiger Woods. So holy cow, was I lucky or what? to be able to see all this as close as I was able to see it. And so I learned a great deal about the men and about, you know, play out there. And I wanted to learn that because I didn't want to just know about women, for heaven's sake. I want to know about people and golfers, you know? And I do remember you one night. I was sitting by myself at a little restaurant in Carmel, California, and you were having dinner, I think, with your wife and maybe a child, I'm not sure. And I was sitting there by the fireplace all alone talking on the phone because it was my birthday. And I didn't have anybody to have dinner with, so I just had my phone, and I was talking to a friend of mine in Dallas. So I had dinner with her. But she was on the phone.
It's the way of the world, isn't it? I mean, traveling with the circus. I managed to spend my birthday just about every year in Moline, Illinois.
Oh, my.
At the John Deere.
Did you get to ride a tractor?
I have ridden the tractors. The tractors are fun.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to talk a little bit about the tournament there this week. One of the longest running sponsors in any sport, Shell. And you're involved also in the Shell Houston Open, I would imagine, in a variety of different ways. You have a function tonight, which is a lot of fun. Talk about that event and the way that it's evolved over the years.
Well, I am just so proud of Houston and Shell Oil for stepping up when they did. Because we had, you know, Coca-Cola for a while, then we had Buick for a while, and then Shell stepped in. And it was the tournament was played here in the Woodlands, which is where I live and also teach. And it was really a hometown event, but we outgrew the Woodlands facility outgrew the tournament. Thankfully, because you want the tournament to get bigger and bigger. And the Redstone Group had reestablished the Redstone properties over there on the east side of the airport, and done a magnificent job. And Jim Hardy and Peter Jacobson did the first course that they played the tournament on, and the players really liked it. And then Reese Jones came in and did the second course, and that's where they play the tournament now. But it's a big stage. It's huge property, and they have much more access to the general population of Houston, which is very spread out anyhow. And so they set records every year for crowds, money to charity and so on. And they've tapped into the corporate community even bigger and better. So Steve Timms and the Houston Golf Association have done a great job with the tournament. And I just couldn't be prouder of what they've done for not just for the charities in Houston, but also junior golf and the First Tee program over there at the Dick Harmon Learning Center. And the property that Redstone invested so much in has been a real boon and a great, very telegenic golf course. So it looks real pretty on TV if people are going to be watching and listening to you.
We can't make it pretty on the radio, but...
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can.
Well, I'm 6'4" and 190 pounds on the radio, just in case anybody's wondering. In real life, you'll be a bit disappointed. I love the Woodlands, though, and was fortunate enough to be there last year for the Insperity, the Champions Tour event. I missed the Woodlands, and I was thrilled to get a chance to come back. What a great community.
Yeah, it sure is, and grown so much since the tournament was held here. We have 100,000 people living here now.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. So many golf courses, and it's just amazing out here at the Woodlands, and it's new stuff is happening all the time.
We
don't have an In-N-Out Burger, though, and I want an In-N-Out Burger.
You'll probably get a Five Guys before you get an In-N-Out.
No, I want a Smash Burger before Five Guys, okay? That's coming.
You heard it here. Sorry, Phil Mickelson. Carol Mann prefers the In-N-Out Burger to the Five Guys. You know, Phil's an investor in Five Guys.
Oh, well, good for him.
You received an honor just a couple of years ago from the PGA of America, their First Lady of Golf Award, which I think not only was it well-deserved, but I would imagine had to be very humbling for you. What was that like to know that you'd been honored by one of the organizations in this country that upholds the flag of golf?
I still shake my head, John. I was stunned when they called me, and not only because it's the PGA of America, which I'm a member, by the way. I'm A4 or something like that, so I don't have to get certification points every year. I'm so proud of the PGA of America and what it has stood for and still stands for and continues to grow in the standing for the health and the well-being of golf and the business of golf. But the other part of it, besides being awarded by them, is the fact that the other women before me were so, so special. Judy Bell, Alice Dye, Carol Semple Thompson, Judy Rankin, Nancy Lopez, people like that. I'm sure I've forgotten Renee Powell. I'm sure I may have forgotten somebody else. But to be in the category with them was, I mean, that's why I was shaking my head because, holy cow, they're like some of my all time heroes.
I think that we can all agree it was well deserved. Before I let you go, and I'm asking this selfishly as much as anything, as the father of a daughter in particular, but a couple of kids who I'm having trouble getting to the golf course. Is there anything we can do to make it more fun, to make golf more accessible to our kids? They have every opportunity to play. It's just not on their priority list.
Well, I would ask one other thing, do they participate in other sports?
Oh, every other sport.
Okay. Well, then let me tell you of a new movement that's occurred in golf. Now, I don't know if you've been exposed to it, but it's something you want to take a look at. And that is somewhat from the Australian model, but also we have, you know, researchers in America that have concluded that this is a positive value, that golf is athletic. And so they have a children's program that's being introduced all around the country. Not, I don't mean SNAG, okay? That's kind of like a golf program for starting new at golf. That's why it's called SNAG. But this program is about movement. And you have to take some training and get it because it's not that big a deal. Throwing, running, catching, jumping, being more athletically fit. And when these young people experience kind of movement and begin to understand through, you know, time after time of doing it, that equates to being better at golf. By having them learn to be more athletic in this little program and laughing and giggling with each other, and sometimes they get punishment if they don't do what the teacher for the tip shot or whatever says, and they have to run over to a target area and run back, and they have to do it within, like, you know, 15 seconds or something. So there are all kinds of additional things that are being put in golf for juniors now. And I find that very fascinating and exciting.
Yeah, I think that any innovation is a good one at this point. I know that you're terribly busy with Houston Open stuff this week. We really do appreciate the time. Will you come back and spend more time with us sometime soon?
Anytime. Come on.
It has been an absolute pleasure to get to spend a few minutes with Carol Mann. Enjoy the party tonight.
Thank you, John, and all the best to you, and stay well.
Thank you.